Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Hello and welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. 1 week from today, voters in New Jersey and Virginia will go to the polls. Even as these are state and, of course, not federal elections, they can serve as bellwethers for the upcoming midterm election. Topics that resonate in a purple state like Virginia this year, for example, are likely to be issues that are significant in swing states and districts in 2026. We're also going to be looking closely at voter turnout for some early clues as to which party is more excited to show up and vote next year. But even as our politics has become more and more nationalized, these contests in Virginia and New Jersey are also impacted by unique state and local issues and trends. And that's why I wanted to discuss these contests with two people who really understand the issues, the electorate, and which parts of the state will be most important to watch on November 4th. Joey Fox of the New Jersey Globe and Chaz Nuddicombe, founder and executive director of State Navigate, who's following the Virginia contests. We recorded this conversation on Wednesday, October 22nd. Hello, Chaz. Hello, Joey. I'm so excited to have you guys here with me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, we are so close to Election Day in Virginia and New Jersey. I want to dig into both of those, but Chaz, this is sort of fortuitous timing. We're here on Wednesday, the 22nd of October. You all, your organization at State Navigator just dropped a Virginia poll with lots of good data in there. Tell us what it shows.
Yeah. So State Navigate, we conducted this poll ourselves. We did everything in-house. So we conducted this from Friday the 17th through the morning of Monday the 20th. So this just came out this morning. So we have a 13-point lead for Abigail Spanberger, 55-42. An 11-point lead for the race for lieutenant governor with Democrat Ghazala Hashmi versus Republican John Reed. And then the tightest one, of course, is the Virginia attorney general race, where Jones is only up 5 with a 50-45 lead over the Republican incumbent Jason Mieres. And then in the House of Delegates generic ballot, all 100 seats in the House of Delegates are up this year. Democrats have a 53-41-point lead in the House generic, which is a 12-point lead. But there's a whole bunch of great tidbits in here. So it's a likely voter sample of the Virginia electorate. And we had a whole bunch of great takeaways on this. Among people who've already voted, it breaks down as 64-35 Spanberger. Spanberger's lead is about 9 points, 54-45, among people who have yet to vote but plan to do so. Either they say they are definitely or probably voting. And then among independent voters, so we asked the question of, okay, which party do you lean toward? And obviously, it usually splits about one third for each party. And then we push and say, well, which party do you lean toward the most, right? Right. Kind of like what Gallup does. And among that 10% of the electorate, Spanberger has a whopping 72-17 lead over Winsome Sears. That would track with normally what I think was the case in like 2017. And another area that Spanberger has been making big gains by, and this is one of the really interesting parts, are lower income voters. Electorate or those who are making less than $30,000 a year, when compared to the 2024 presidential margin for that group in Virginia, it's a 10-point swing in favor of Spanberger. For those who are making $30,000 to $50,000 a year, a 2-point swing. And 7% of Spanberger voters in the survey are voting for Mieres, either definitely voting for him or leading toward him. And Spanberger's 68 to 29 among moderates. So those are the big takeaways, I think, that are really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk a little bit about this, because, Chaz, I know that you have, rightly so, been somewhat critical of the public polling out there that has modeled for an electorate that looks more like 2024 or 2022 than it does 2025. It is one of the classic challenges for polling, right, is trying to figure out, well, what does the electorate look like this year, not what did it look like back in the last election. So tell us what your assumptions are of who's going to turn out in this election.
So I like to think about Virginia elections. We have elections every year in Virginia.
Yep.
When it comes to forecasting them and trying to predict the outcome, I would say it's like a mile-long racetrack. The first quarter mile is the presidential election. Second quarter mile is the gubernatorial. Third quarter mile is the midterm. And the fourth quarter mile is when every seat in the General Assembly in the state Senate and House of Delegates is up. The closer you are to the end of the track, the easier it is to forecast what the electorate is going to look like. And what we usually see in this second quarter mile, let's say, when the gubernatorial year starts, is that the out party of the White House has a higher share of the electorate. This is what happened in 2021. Biden won Virginia by 10.11% in 2020, and the electorate was about Biden plus three in 2021. You have some of these pollsters who are waiting in 2021 who are making a very big mistake, I believe, because 2021, you had an incumbent Democratic president.
Yeah, it was an incumbent Democrat. It was a Democrat who was in the White House, who was dealing with record high inflation, with the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan, right? It's a totally different political climate than where we sit today, especially with all of the DOGE cuts, government shutdown, and of course, a Republican, not just in the White House, but in the State House. One last question for you before I go to Joey. Obviously, the marquee race now is the Attorney General's race. For those who are listening who haven't been paying much attention to this, maybe you've heard it peripherally, but text messages, private text messages sent by the Democratic Attorney General candidate while he was a legislator, which advocated, among other things, for shooting his political rival, the then Republican Speaker of the House, as well as wanting or wishing death upon that speaker's children. That came out, I think, the beginning of October, right? Before this story broke. So for the early vote, Jones was on track to basically match the rest of how the other Democratic statewide candidates were doing. Now he's trailing far behind. Tell us what you think it would take for Mieres to do something that we haven't seen in Virginia in 20 years, which is to win a statewide race while the rest of his ticket loses.
Yeah. So one note is technically on the story, Jones was a former legislator when those texts were sent.
Okay.
He resigned from the House of Delegates in January 2022 and sent those to a Republican delegate, Kerry Coyner, in August 2022.
Got it.
Jason Mieres has surged in our forecast in the odds and like closing in on the margin. Jones has a 4.5% lead in our forecast right now. And I think that's probably going to tighten, you know, over the next week or so, over the next 2 weeks, as more and more polls come in and the old ones go out, right?
Yep.
At the beginning of the month, he was leading by about 8, Jones was. And Spanberger and the governor race and Hashmi and the lieutenant governor race haven't really seen their numbers change in the forecast. So Jones has really dropped like a rock. Jason Mieres has been picking up Democrats. And you can see that in the crosstabs. I forget what percent among Harris voters and, you know, Democratic ID voters Maris is winning. But again, he is winning 7% of people who are saying they're voting for Spamberger. And in the people who have not voted yet, I believe Maris had like a 1-point lead, or maybe Jones had a 1-point lead. Whereas in the people who already voted in the race for attorney general, they said Jones had it like a 17-point lead or something like that.
Either people are consciously splitting their ticket, or I can see a lot of Spanberger voters just dropping off, right? They just leave it blank. What's that number need to look like, Chads, in order for Maris to win?
You know, I was kind of surprised he's getting 7, because that's what I was having a ceiling at just a few days ago. So I would kind of expand that ceiling as a result of the poll to maybe like 8 to 8.5 of percent of Spanberger voters. And then he probably need about maybe like 2 or 3% of Spanberger voters to just not vote in the attorney general race. But here's the thing in the poll that you can see is that Jones has a lot of soft support compared to all the other Democrats in the race. There's a lot of people who say they're probably voting for Jones, or when we push our undecideds, they're leaning toward Jones, right? So that's kind of one of the things to watch for, is if Maris, who's running ads like from the gubernatorial debate, that's where, you know, Spanberger's endorsing Jones and saying, look, she's not endorsing Jones, you can vote for me, right?
Exactly.
If he can continue to pull off Spanberger supporters and Jones continues to just get hammered on the airwaves like he has been in the last few weeks, then Maris has a very good path to victory, unless there is a much bluer environment. And we'll be able to see if that happens. The satellites in Virginia just opened up these early in-person voting locations, which are in predominantly blue localities. And thus far, the EV has been about as blue as 2024, even though there's been 1 to 2 week delays in a lot of these localities. So that's another one of the signs we're looking at a bluer electorate than 2024. The question is, how much bluer?
That is going to be fascinating to watch. And then I just want to shift to New Jersey for some time here, Joey, because the sort of national narrative has been, while Spanberger has really from the beginning sort of been running away with the governor's race, in New Jersey, it's a different story, where Mikey Sherrill, the Democrat, should be, this is again, conventional thinking, should be winning by a bigger margin, but the polls show a consistently tighter race. Tell me what you are seeing there and what you think is going on in New Jersey that makes this race more competitive than what some folks would think New Jersey should look like, given how blue it's been over the last many years?
I mean, I guess the first two ways that I'll respond to that are to kind of, I think that two of the key points that people maybe don't fully integrate when they're thinking about how New Jersey and Virginia compare here. One is that as of the 2024 presidential election specifically, they are about equal politically.
Right.
They voted for Kamala Harris by really, really similar margins. And so this long-held idea that we've got where New Jersey is a safe blue state and Virginia is a swing state, at least according to this one election, doesn't really apply anymore. They're in a relatively similar boat partisanship-wise. And it would be something of a surprise now if New Jersey were to vote substantially bluer than Virginia, which I don't think anybody really thinks is going to happen. The other thing I'll say is New Jersey has a pretty consistent history of trading off between the parties for governorships. It tends to elect a governor of a party, re-elect that governor, or, you know, maybe elect a different governor of the same party. And then after those two terms, be like, okay, we did that. We're ready to move on to the next thing. Phil Murphy is neither crazy popular nor crazy unpopular. But I think that both candidates, Mikey Sherrill and Jack Ciattarelli, in the race kind of recognized that there is nevertheless an appetite to move on from him in some key ways. Jack Ciattarelli can obviously make that message extremely cleanly. He can say, I'm going to change all of this. I ran against him in 2021, et cetera, et cetera. Sherrill has to do a little bit more of a tightrope walk with that. At one of the debates, she gave Murphy a B. So kind of be like...
That's right. Right. And you're like, I mean, is that bad? Is that good?
Yeah, exactly. It's a signal to his supporters that he's fine, but it's a signal to his detractors that she thinks that what he's doing can be improved upon.
That's right.
And, you know, since Chad spent a while talking about polls, I guess I'll give a little bit of a sort of an overview of the New Jersey polling landscape. It's been really surprisingly steady, at least in sort of the October stretch of the race.
Yep.
Where pollsters, I mean, Rutgers Eagleton had Sherrill up by 5. Fox News had Sherrill up by 5. Fairleigh Dickinson University had Sherrill up by 7. Quinnipiac University had Cheryl up by 6. Approach hit a really super PAC had Cheryl up by 3 or 4. A Cheryl internal poll, I believe, had her up by 7 as well. These are pollsters that are coming at this race from a bunch of different agendas, a bunch of different physical locations and styles. They're all coming out with a kind of similar result. And that maybe indicates that that is, in fact, where the race stands. Yeah. And I think that any journalist has to also be a little bit nervous that there might be some hurting going on.
Yeah.
That we have decided where the New Jersey governor's race lands. And then these polls are weighting their electorates and sort of figuring out a way to make their poll land within that band of sort of logical outcomes. I think that you saw in both 2021 and 2024, pollsters all kind of land on a place where the race probably was. Phil Murphy up by, I don't know, 9 points or something in 2021. Kamala Harris up by 14 points in 2024. That kind of matched with what the reasonable expectations would be, what past election results would be. Then in both cases, none of the pollsters, or very few of the pollsters, really caught the massive swing that was going to happen. They were all kind of assuming that we were just going to go down a regular path, and then we didn't really.
Yep.
And the one more thing I'll add to that before I let you talk again. I remember in 2021, it was a little bit strange. I mean, New Jersey was a bluer state than Virginia at that time based on partisanship, but it wasn't that much bluer. It was around 6 points bluer in the 2020 presidential election. And so it was a little strange leading into 2021 that people knew that Virginia was extremely competitive and even that Glenn Youngkin was a little bit favored, but we're also treating a Phil Murphy victory like a foregone conclusion. Because if you assume that, you know, there are independent state level factors in all these races, but if you assume there's a coherent national environment that both of these electorates are going to be voting in, then a massive swing in one not matched in the other would be a little odd. And so I do kind of look at the poll showing Spanberger way up in Virginia and then the poll showing Cheryl ahead by a much smaller margin in New Jersey. That's perfectly logical. You can see how you get to each of those results. You can see why the matchup in Virginia is more favorable for Democrats, why the situation is more favorable. But I would ultimately come away a little bit surprised on election day if Mikey Cheryl wins by 3 and Abigail Spanberger wins by 14 or whatever. That would be a pretty substantial divergence. It would mean that the there isn't really a coherent national electorate. It would mean that the two state electorates are in entirely different places. So I kind of wonder if come election day, we're going to either see New Jersey be bluer than we expect or Virginia be redder than expect. And sort of the canary in the coal mine for that, but we don't know it yet, was the other state.
There's a clear inequality between these two races, though, and who the incoming governor is.
Well, that's what I was going to get at. And this comes to really both of you all, which is, I'm about 162 years older than you all are, but back in my day, all politics was local. And so it wouldn't be that weird, Joey, to see, like, of course, New Jersey is different because it has a different, these candidates are different. The quality of the candidates are different. As Chaz pointed out, you've got a Democratic incumbent in Virginia. You have a Republican incumbent in office. But yet we also know that we are in a nationalized era. And that in both cases, the Democrats are hoping that Trump basically trumps everything else, right? And I wanted to get at that specifically, Joey, first with you, because it seems like no matter what the polls have shown in terms of the margin, it seems like Cittorelli is basically matching where Trump's approval rating is. And Chaz, wondering if you're seeing the same thing in Virginia. In other words, is the Trump number going to be the definitive number to watch? Or is it, Chaz, what you were saying is we may be missing something in the uniqueness of the local piece of these elections?
I think there absolutely is a uniqueness to the local piece in both of these elections.
Yeah.
I think that Jack Cittorelli is one of the strongest candidates that Republicans could reasonably hope for. He's got a strong statewide profile. He has sort of a proven ability to both make his case as a Trump supporter, but also make his case as someone for whom that's not, you know, his main priority. You saw in 2021 that I think a lot of otherwise sort of, you know, moderate or even Democratic leaning voters were sort of willing to take his word on that. And I think Mikey Cheryl has smartly and really consistently tried to make it clear that, no, this is a guy that whatever he says, you know, he supports Trump 100%. And Cittorelli isn't necessarily helping his case when he gives debate answers like, I give Trump an A.
Yeah.
I wouldn't really disagree with him on anything, you know, not really taking him to task on any of the things that are obvious political losers in New Jersey, like the Gateway Tunnel. And, you know, Cheryl is banking on there being this big core of voters in New Jersey who whatever their opinions on property taxes, whatever their opinions on whether they think Phil Murphy kind of needs to go or whatever it may be, that they are not going to ultimately pull the lever for a Trump-aligned candidate, that that is just sort of a bridge too far. And that's a little bit of a harder sell this year than it was in prior years, simply because New Jersey has a lot more Trump voters than it did in prior years. You're sort of working, if you're going off of voters who would never, ever consider Donald Trump, voting for Donald Trump, then you've got a smaller slice of the electorate than you did in the past. But at the same time, Trump still did lose New Jersey by 6 points. I think if Mikey Sherrill comes out of election night with a 6-point victory, Democrats are not going to be like over the moon, but they're going to be pretty solidly happy with that. So you can see exactly where that strategy is coming from.
So Chaz, yeah, talk about that a little bit. I mean, Earl Sears, I think we could both agree that she is not as strong a candidate as Cittarelli is in New Jersey. She has the added baggage of DOGE cuts that hit uniquely hard in a place like Virginia. So she has a lot more of a headwind going against her, let's say, than Cittarelli. How much do you see that Spanberger's success is a reflection of those things versus the fact that the electorate today is just that much more aligned with where Democrats are than it was back in 2021?
Yeah, well, I do think that Spanberger is going to do a better time at pulling over Trump voters in the electorate in Virginia than Sherrill is going to do. I would like to say I do understand that the saying that all politics is national. I still believe that to some degree, all politics is local. And I do think one kind of different dynamic in Virginia than compared to New Jersey is that I think our elections are a little more nationalized. I mean, we have elected a governor opposite of the president incumbent party every single gubernatorial election since 1977, with the exception of 2013, when Terry McAuliffe won the governor race while Obama was in the White House. Democrats haven't won three terms, they have a two-term limit, so we need to get a new governor. Three terms in the governor's mansion. Is that what it's called over there, the governor's mansion in Jersey? This is what we call it here.
It's called Drumthwacket.
I love that name. It is the best.
It's so good. We also keep on electing really wealthy governors who don't live there. So it's almost a little bit of a misnomer to say like they're moving into Drumthwacket because oftentimes they don't. Phil Murphy doesn't live there.
Okay. Today I learned. But either way, they haven't held the governorship for three terms and over, I think it's been like 100 years.
It was the 1950s that the last time.
Was it the 1950s?
There was a pair of two-term Democratic governors.
It was the 1950s, which essentially was 100 years ago, Chaz. It's
yeah,
okay.
from a political perspective,
Nobody remembers the 1950s.
But yeah, so I think that, and if you look at, the gubernatorial races in New Jersey since 1977, it doesn't really follow that pattern as much. It usually does, but not always. Just like, in 2021, New Jersey did not elect a candidate for governor opposite of the incumbent, in the White House, right? So I think politics, I feel like, is a little more national in Virginia. I wonder if it's because we're closer. But yeah, on your note with DOGE and everything, when you look at our poll, Spanberger has been gaining a little bit of ground in Nova. But actually, her biggest ground that she's made up is in her home base of Richmond. And so we separated things into media markets. So Richmond and Charlottesville media market, Spanberger leads by 24 points. That region was plus 10 Harris. Nova was, the Nova media market, or, DC, was plus 20 Harris. And Spanberger is getting a bump there by 7 points. She leads by 27.
But to that local and national, Chaz, isn't that essentially what the attorney general's race is really going to turn on? Right. If the Jones campaign is really hoping that by drilling this message that a vote for Meares is a vote for Donald Trump, and he will be Donald. I think his ad now is he will be Donald Trump's attorney general, not yours. That's enough to convince even those who are uneasy with Jones to pull the lever for him.
Yeah. So, Jones mentioned Trump 35 times, if I recall correctly, is the number in the attorney general debate. And I really wish somebody counted the amount of interruptions that were in the gubernatorial debate by Winsome Sears to see which one of those numbers was higher. But look, at the end of the day, this electorate is 100% going to be a majority Harris electorate. If you believe that this electorate in Virginia is one that voted for Donald Trump in 2024, I have a great long-term investment property for you to buy on Tangier Island. That's a little bit of a Virginia joke because in our lifetime, Tangier Island is supposed to sink.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, Jones is, he seemed to move his strategy a little bit in ads and everything, just really honing on Trump, playing like it's 2017, which all he really needs to do, right? If he wins a majority of the Harris voters, he wins. So I think that's a sound strategy for him to just be able to squeak by, which it seems like is his goal. I mean, there seems to be, this is going to be the highest amount of ticket splitting in Virginia since 2013, when there was an 11-point gap between the race for lieutenant governor and attorney general. So, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's whether people care about the text or whether people are upset with President Trump.
Quick break, and we'll be back with Chaz Nuddicombe and Joey Fox. If you want to stay up to date on all redistricting news, check out our new redistricting tracker. We'll be continually updating it as we get news of midterm redistricting in states. The CPR redistricting tracker is only available to Cook Political Report subscribers, so consider subscribing today. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. The offer is available only to new subscribers. Joey, I'll start with you, and then Chaz, I want to get to you about this. Everybody is suddenly going to become an expert on New Jersey and Virginia the day after the election, and they are going to tell us, what does it mean for 2026? So I want to get my experts here to tell us what you think these elections will tell us about 2026, and maybe more specifically, what is it that you're going to be looking at as the results come in and as the results become finalized that are going to be important for folks out here in the national political environment to understand?
So, I mean, what I'm going to be looking for most closely is results just in New Jersey specific to swing districts, in the 7th district and the 9th district.
You're talking about the 7th and the 9th congressional district.
The congressional districts, yes. Sorry.
Yes.
I mean, this is something that, you know, I'm going to spend a couple of weeks after the election, you know, crunching the numbers and figuring out exactly how these districts vote, because I think that that will be, it will not be a total crystal ball for what's going to happen in 2026, but I think it'll give us a really good indication of how the parties are doing in those two districts. And, you know, I'm not a national analyst, so I wouldn't necessarily make national conclusions out of this, but someone else easily could. So the 9th district is a longtime Democratic district. This is Nellie Poe's district based in Patterson, formerly Bill Pascrell. That was, you know, Biden plus 19 and then Trump plus one. It was one of the biggest swings of any district in the nation, certainly one of the biggest swings of a competitive district in the nation. Nellie Poe thought that she was going to have a relatively smooth tenure in the House, and she was immediately thrust into the spotlight as one of the Democratic caucus's most vulnerable members. So I'm really going to be interested in watching the Chitterelli margin there. My baseline assumption is that Chitterelli is going to do at least a little bit worse, at least by margin, if not by turnout, in heavily minority areas that shifted towards Trump in 2024. That's just sort of a classic down ballot lag situation. Phil Murphy, even as he was doing way worse in 2021, did actually a little better in Hispanic areas than Biden did. But so if you look at this district on election night and Chitterelli is winning it like Trump did or coming really close, then that's a massive alarm bell, both for Nellie Poe specifically and just for Democrats in New Jersey and around the country about these gains that we saw Trump make in 2024, they weren't just a Trump thing.
Exactly. They're more sturdy than many Democrats would hope that they were, right?
Right. All of these voters who had voted for Democrats their entire lives or maybe had voted before are now actually like pretty consistent Republicans who will turn out even for Jack Chitterelli, even in this off-year election.
Yep.
And then the 7th district is sort of the opposite story, where this is Tom Kaine Jr. This is a district that's flipped back and forth a few times. Kaine beat Tom Malinowski in 2022 after redistricting made the district redder. And this is the kind of area where you could see Cheryl doing, just based on her past profile, doing decently well. This is the district that borders her own congressional district. It's demographically similar in a lot of ways. Fairly wealthy, very suburban.
Yep.
And I wouldn't necessarily set the bar quite the same as I would in the ninth. I think it would take a lot for Sherrill to win this district. In for context, in 2021, Chitterelli won it by more than 12 points. So this is a district that is very sort of rock-ribbed Republican on a state level and has only been more interested in sort of flirting with Democrats on a national level. But if you come out of election night with Chitterelli winning the 7th district by 4 points, that to me is sort of the flashing alarm bell for Republicans.
Right.
Just like we saw in, you know, I feel like the Virginia House of Delegates elections in 2017 kind of being an omen of suburban gains for Democrats in 2018, that kind of result would tell me, oh, you know, sort of the suburbanites who have been powering Democratic wins for the last 9 years are going to keep doing that. They're going to keep shifting even further left. I mean, this is a district that voted for Trump last year. So if you see Sherrill actually winning it, then that's sort of, that might be kind of lights out. That's really, really dangerous for Republicans. And then again, you can, just like in the ninth district, you can start taking national implications from that about what the suburbs are doing and what these wealthy sort of high-end districts are thinking about in the second Trump era.
Chaz, what about you? Joy brought up the House of Delegates. You all polled there. What are you looking for in terms of its prelude to 2026, or, you know, an insight into what this could mean for Democrats as they're thinking about, and Republicans about their chances in 2026?
Well, I'll start off with just kind of Virginia look at the congressional districts here.
Yep.
I mean, the first congressional district, which is America's first district, has Jamestown and everything, right? So it has the Middle Peninsula and Northern Neck Peninsula and America's First Peninsula, as well as the Richmond suburbs in Henrico and Chesterfield. This is a Trump plus six district. Spanberger is probably going to flip that district if there's a 14-point swing in the Richmond Richmond/Charlottesville media market. That's our home base. And look, like, the Richmond suburbs are continually to get more unfriendly for Republicans, especially Chesterfield now. It used to be like, oh, Henrico. But now a lot of Yankees moving west from Chesterfield.
A lot of golf communities there in Chesterfield, I noticed.
There are. So that's moving it leftward with just population shifts, as well as just, I mean, I think Democrats being very well organized there. But yes, look, in the House of Delegates, there is not really much of a difference between the 2023 House of Delegates results compared to the 2022 congressional results. The statewide popular vote in 2022 for the U.S. House was about, in Virginia, was about D+3. And then the House of Delegates in 2023 is about D+2. So it's becoming increasingly predictive of what the midterm is probably going to look like. So I think that, you know, looking at how many seats for Dems win in the House of Delegates, we have them picking up 8 right now. I think if they're picking up eight, you're looking at probably after redistricting, unless Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act falls, right. In which case that changes the landscape drastically in favor of the Republicans, you're probably looking at about a toss-up in the House. If the Dems are picking up something like 10 to, I think their ceiling is probably 14 on a very, very good night. I'd be very surprised if they got that 14, though, so I'll be more comfortable with saying 13. If they're in that range, they're probably favored to win the House in an environment that's probably almost as blue as 2018, I would say, when controlling for trends in Virginia and controlling for, you know, just campaign quirks and differences in the House of Delegates stuff this year. So I would look for how many seats Dems pick up in the House, but I would put that asterisk with just, we have to see whether Section 2 continues to live or whether we are going to see it fall and drastically change the landscape of the House. And so I'm controlling for like California and those changes.
But for sure.
If that falls, totally different ballgame.
Absolutely. But just, it will tell us a little bit about what the, at least what the political environment under these lines, under the current lines, assuming that, would look like. Can you all give us something that is a top issue in the state, whether it is what's going on in the governor's or other statewide races, or maybe in these legislative races, that you think isn't getting enough attention when we talk about these two states? Like, what is a topic, what is an issue that candidates are talking about, that the campaigns are focused on, that voters are very interested in, that doesn't get enough attention at the national level and you think will be something we'll be hearing more about as we go into elections in the next year and beyond?
You know, I mean, look, cost of living is probably the number one issue right now. I would say for something that's not really like on the airwaves as much, but it's very, very salient, are them data centers that are just being popping up like hot, you know, like all over the place for Virginia. And it's people are pissed that it's driving up their electricity costs. In 2023, this was something that Republicans were able to win on in Prince William County in like a northern area in the rural Crescent in those state legislative elections. They railed against the county government for approving these. But now I think this is something that's working for the Dems. When I was watching that gubernatorial debate, Spanberger said, you know, the data centers need to pay their fair share. Sears didn't really rail against the data centers. And look, this is not a Nova issue anymore. I'm from Richmond and I'm from Hanover. They're thinking about putting one in Hanover, just on the border from Reco and Hanover. Those people are not going to be happy with that. They're putting one in Goochland. They're putting one in Louisa. So these things are popping all over the place. And of course, the governor likes it because, well, more jobs, more money, right? But people are pissed about their electricity bills. And a lot of them are kind of talking about these data centers as well, kind of linked to that, whether it be the environmental pollution that it has or the noise that it makes if it's near them, or, you know, well, you know, just the fact that it's driving people's electricity bills up. So I haven't really seen that much on the airwaves, but I was astonished with just how much of a fumble the Winsome Sears had in that debate. I mean, people talk about, you know, her talking about a gay marriage issue, right? Like her saying that's not discrimination for being against gay marriage. But I think the biggest moment, honestly, in hindsight, even though that was a very much a gaffe, was her pretty much giving Spanberger the point for where people are on data centers. And this is not a Democrat versus Republican issue. This is a, I would say, especially something that resonates with rural voters. They are pissed to high hell about these.
Right. And they're getting put up all over the country in those sort of exurban areas.
I mean, New Jersey has kind of a parallel issue, actually, where warehouse construction is a big thing in a lot of the state's rural, more rural areas, where a bunch of farmland and forest land gets just converted into these sprawling warehouses. And that ends up being a big issue in like local and county races. It hasn't, I feel like, quite made the leap up into, you know, full state level discourse.
Right.
But what definitely has is suburban development. New Jersey, obviously a very suburban state. It's, you know, the way that it's specifically designed, like the literal subdivisions of New Jersey, where it's 564 towns. Most of those towns are, you could qualify them as suburban. People move to them because they want, like, you know, a specific type of life. And there's definitely, Jack Chitarella has tried to make this into an issue where Democrats are wanting to overdevelop your suburb. They want to turn your quaint little downtown into a bunch of high rises. There's also sort of the angle of affordable housing, where New Jersey has really strong state level sort of mandates on affordable housing that Democrats recently sort of strengthened even further. And Republicans have really kind of pitched a fit on that and are trying to definitely make that into an issue.
There's like a farm that's like been in a family's generations for hundreds of years and all that.
Yeah, that's in Cranberry. That's sort of, that has become the cause célèbre of this particular kind of anti-overdevelopment movement. In some ways, I think that Chitarelli and Sherrill are talking past each other on the issue of development, because Chitarelli is saying we can't overdevelop the suburbs, and Sherrill is saying like her plan includes constructing a lot more houses, turning, you know, disused office space and things like that into new homes, trying to make it trying to take a more YIMBY styled approach to housing in New Jersey. One would think that those two positions would kind of clash. I haven't really, it's an issue that you ask for issues that haven't sort of fully broken into the national mainstream yet. In some ways, I feel like this isn't even an issue that's fully broken into the New Jersey mainstream yet, because the parties don't sort of have, in my opinion, don't have incredibly coherent sort of ways that they're going at each other on it. They just are sort of generally tapping into, Sherrill is saying there's not enough housing, why is rent so expensive? And Chitarelli is saying, you don't like that new building in your suburb? Well, vote for me.
Right, right.
Kind of like chips in the night there.
Right. It's affordability, but how they're trying to make that case is very different. And we're probably going to see a lot more talk of this issue of affordability and housing affordability, not just in the midterm elections, but as we go into 2028. You guys have been awesome. I really appreciate it. Here's the final question for you. How can people on election night and beyond follow what you all are saying?
So I'm the executive director of State Navigate. We're a 501c3 nonpartisan nonprofit. We are based in Virginia, but we are national. We're in five states right now, I believe, Wisconsin, West Virginia, South Carolina, Utah, and Virginia. Go to statenavigate.org. And if you want election night in Virginia, you got to come to us because we're going to have a live model of the projected margin for each statewide race and the odds of victory, that sort of thing, and projected margin for every single seat in the House of Delegates. And to my knowledge, we're the only folks that are doing that. So you will want to be at statenavigate.org/Virginia.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have the same, super, super fancy tech skills as Chaz does. So, we're not going to have any live models that you can hover over and have fun with. But definitely still go to the newjerseyglobe.com, or newjerseyglobe.com, I should say. We'll be calling races all night on election night. I'll be writing stories for weeks afterwards that are breaking down the results, saying what's happening. I'll also give a shout out to, you know, we're a small news organization. There's a lot of New Jersey media scene is tough. There's a lot of small news organizations that are trying to make it. So I would say Politico NJ, New Jersey Monitor, NJ Spotlight News, Brent Johnson at NJ.com. I think we're sort of a tight knit press corps, and I would encourage you to check out all of them too, because we're not going to be able to realistically cover everything, but hopefully in the aggregate, we'll give you a pretty good picture. You can also follow me on Twitter at JoeyMDFox. But yeah, we'll be doing our best to keep you informed.
Oh, I love this. And yes, shout out to all the small, both nonprofit and otherwise organizations out there covering the really important elections that get left behind sometimes by the bigger media groups. Joey, Chaz, thank you guys so much for taking the time in a very, very busy time to break down both of these very important states.
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.